Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett.
Hi, this is Chris Chapelman.
And welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. So Chris and I thought we would record another episode here, but I told him that the conversation I wanted to have with him, I wasn't going to tell him in advance. I was just going to jump in on it and see what he thought. And it's based in an article that I recently read. And the article is very surprising. It said that Toyota is going to recall all of the 1993 Toyota Camrys, and which is weird. But the statement from Tokyo is that it's simply time for drivers to move on. They said that they understand that the 93 Camry was tremendously dependable, but honestly, there's just no excuse for driving a 24-year-old car. You should have updated features like Bluetooth and a backup camera. While Toyota is reportedly confining its recall to the 93 Camry, it's also issuing a warning to 94 to 1998 models, alerting them to the fact that they're really starting to push it.
Wow.
So I love that. It's obviously a spoof article, but I love it because it just highlights just, you know, how amazing, how well Toyota nailed it with that one car model, where the percentage of them that are still on the road is outstanding. And the idea of doing a recall just because they're saying you got to let go of something you love is pretty good. So what I want to talk about that I think is interesting is that after I read that, I looked up a list of some of the most reliable cars throughout, you know, the years that have existed. And, you know, there was lots of different models on there that you'd recognize. But one thing clearly jumped out at me, and I'm very interested in your thoughts on this. I noticed on that list that eight of them were, I forgot if it was like a top 20. I'm doing this by memory, but eight of them were Toyotas. Lots of other manufacturers only had one or two models on there. So, you know, some of these really big manufacturers just had like one model that made it. Toyota had eight. So what comes to mind is, if you only get one model on that list and you've been an automotive manufacturer for 100 years, are you doing it right, or did you just get lucky that one time? Because if you have eight of them on there, you're doing it right and you know how to do it again, which means you know why it's right. And we also know that Toyota, right, there's the Toyota way, and everybody's written a gazillion things on it. And, you know, they do have something to share in that. So what do you think about that? Do you think, am I being kind of overly critical at the idea of people who just have one on there?
I would think that's by choice. I think that other companies would make the choice, at least a good number of them will make the choice, that there's something more important than reliability that they invest in for their cars. There are people that buy luxury cars that don't have that type of reliability, unless maybe it's a Lexus, and they still buy them because the customer is looking for something other than reliability, or something that is more important to them, like image or features, than just pure reliability. And there are probably manufacturers out there that strive to be like Toyota, but just can't get to that point. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They probably don't understand why.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's interesting. So you're saying that Toyota has taken it as a core component of their brand, and that's why this is something that is consistent throughout their products, whereas other manufacturers might have a model that they are gearing towards that customer base, that reliability is everything. But there are other ones, they're well aware those customers are willing to compromise that for higher performance or certain features or something. Okay, so that's kind of interesting that it's intentional.
Yeah, it could be. It could also be the internal structure of a company, where at Toyota, I would guess that the sole idea of reliability permeates the organization through throughout the world in different design centers, whereas maybe companies that have one model up there, you know, the group that's responsible of that model has leadership that values reliability more than maybe other managers and other groups that make other models.
Yeah, or they got promoted out of being a contributor to design. Oh, that happens too.
Yeah,
the best ones get promoted to where they're just in meetings all day as upper, you know, middle upper management. They don't, you know, they end up in the business end of the organization, and then that skill set and information can get lost. Yeah, unless you do like Toyota, where you make it a part of the fabric of your culture.
Yeah.
So the other thing too that, you know, I kind of wonder there is, have you seen, and made me think about too, if I've seen where companies have a product that's good and strong, we'll call it their workhorse, and they then end up in a situation of surprise when they make a derivative of that workhorse. You know, they don't change it entirely, but they upgrade it to some degrees, or, you know, make it becomes a legacy product, and their new version is not very stable, not very reliable, has a lot of issues and bugs that they're chasing right off the bat. So does that kind of put out the statement that it was just luck that workhorse was so reliable, that there was lots of variabilities that weren't in control and they just were lucky they didn't overlap, and then they changed one little thing and some of them started to overlap and drive failures?
That could be one reason why. I could think of another reason too, is that for the initial product, they put a lot more thought and testing into it, and took a long time to get that product to a good, stable, reliable place before they launched it or while it was in the market. And now they're making changes, but there's a lot of time pressure or financial pressure, and they don't want to go through that entire process. And they just overlook and skip some steps, and they overlook new failure modes that they introduced and didn't know they introduced.
Yeah. No, I think you're right with that, because it's easy to take for granted, oh, this is a really good product, we're just changing this one thing or two things or three things, so we don't, you know, just push forward. That probably is very common. Let's take a moment for a break, and we'll be right back.
Hi there. It's Fred here. Do you or those around you use MTBF? If so, I have to ask you why. Check out my short book, The Reliability Metric, a quick and valuable improvement over MTBF. In it, you will find details on how just poor metric MTBF is for reliability, and specifics on what you should do instead. A useful reliability metric will help you and your team make better decisions. To find out more and to get a copy, go to ascendoreliability.com/go/metric.
Okay, we're back. Sorry, Chris, I cut you off there. Is you about to say something?
Yeah, I was just thinking, what I've seen other companies do is when they make a derivative of a product, that they do an analysis of what has changed, a change point analysis, or some companies call it new, unique, different, or difficult, and focus on those things that changed and do FMEAs around those change points rather than a full-blown FMEA on the entire product. Mm-hmm. And you're hopefully catching all the things, the new failure modes that you would have introduced.
Yep. There's a term I hear called, that makes me cringe, FMEA light. I've heard people say, oh, we did an FMEA light on that. You know, we just focused in the areas. And I'm like, oh, no.
So what's your experience with that?
With FMEA light?
Yeah.
I don't participate in them because it's effectively going into something, generating the answers you knew you wanted to in advance. It's not the exploratory process that I think that it's supposed to be. So, I mean, of course, you can be precise in them. You should, you know, do an FMEA within a scope that's, you know, reasonable. But that's correctly scoping it. I think when people say FMEA light, a lot of times that results in one or two people who are expert in it sitting down and documenting kind of what they already know is a lot of times what it looks like to me when I see them afterwards. that is totally different than the intent, which is for a, you know, a multidisciplinary group to be, you know, hypothesizing and questioning each other, you know, and capturing this in a document that then creates areas that rank high to focus on with regard to where your risk is. So yeah, that word sets off alarms for me when I hear that.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so when I was thinking about the change point analysis and doing an FMEA, I don't know that I would call it FMEA light, but just focus on the area that's changed, I would think you could still be effective in discovering potential failure modes and potential risks that you then can go and act on.
What does that look like to you, though? But when you say that, so I mean, I believe in correctly scoping it. You know, you don't have to sit down and do the whole, you know, huge system yeah. every time. But I mean, but I imagine what you're describing that you're saying is effective is that there's 5 to 6 disciplines represented in the room. Is that still the case, do you think? Or
yeah, I do struggle with who to have in an FMEA.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe I would have fewer people, maybe 2 to 4 disciplines, but yep. I don't know that that's the right answer.
Yeah.
That's just yeah. what I would do. And so you could think you have a widget that you're making and you've done FMEA for it and you've launched it into the market. And now all of a sudden you want to use it for a different application where it's in a different environment and maybe it's mounted differently. So now you can do an FMEA and look at what are the risks associated with that new environment or with a new way that you're mounting that widget.
Yeah. That's, I think that's well scoped. Yeah. Yeah. The FMEA light word is for some reason, something I've heard different groups say, like not even the same company, different companies. And it always kind of makes me like, wait, what do you mean? You know, so, but I definitely agree with good focus scoping. Yeah. No, it's interesting. It's interesting to know. It's definitely something I consider with regard to a level of organizational maturity. There's a big difference between, you know, having good product and knowing why you have good product. I see that as two very different things.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't just want to be lucky. Mm. You want to know why things are working correctly.
Yeah.
One thing I do struggle with is let's take an FMEA, and if you do an FMEA and you're an automotive or aerospace supplier, you would do a lot more detail in an FMEA and spend a lot more time on it than if you made a consumer product or a product for the office environment. So how do you approach those FMEAs differently? Because you don't get the buy-in, the same buy-in to spend the same time of resources, same amount of resources and times of the engineers on an FMEA if you're not in an automotive or aerospace or medical.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, I think one of the first things with that is to always have somebody you designate as a facilitator of the DFMEA or PFMEA. And this needs to be somebody different than who's documenting. It can't be you can't have the same person filling in the sheet as people are speaking as truly facilitating and orchestrating what's going on. Without a good facilitator, a tremendous amount of time gets wasted in discussions that could have been, you know, redirected, requested to take offline and bring back to the next meeting. I really think you can do a good DFMEA on something of just about any size in 3 to 4 2-hour sessions. I don't think it has to be these massive endeavors. So that kind of takes the resource question off the table, I feel. Because asking a team to be together for anywhere from 6 to 8 hours of in-meeting time plus, you know, analysis time outside, if you can't invest that in your product, you're kind of in a bad situation and you're also fooling yourself because you will invest far more than that, effectively doing a lot of the DFMEA steps informally, right? How many regular design review meetings do you have? All these like standing meetings that just consume a tremendous amount of time. a lot of them are discussing the types of things that are components of a DFMEA, hypothetical failure modes, observations, areas of risk, but it's all unorganized information that gets lost or is just there in the conversation, and you don't even have necessarily control over who's in the room. So I really feel like the DFMEA in some cases can save actual program time because it's taking actions that happen and organizing them, as long as it's underneath the guidance of a good facilitator. If it's just left to its own, DFMEAs can drag on forever and really not be effective. So I kind of have a hard time with the resource argument against DFMEAs.
Okay. I get another question for you then. I've been in FMEAs and we ended up with over 150 line items, and maybe that's reasonable, maybe not, but the time it takes to review those later and follow up actions, it becomes unwieldy. And then the pressure is, we got to go to market quick. We don't have time to sit down for hours and hours to review these. What if you seen in your professional life so far, like what's a reasonable amount of line items, and yes, at some point you just look at the highest scores and
right. Well, I think it's important to frame that in the principle that really, when you get down to it, DFMEA is not an engineering tool; it's a project management tool. If you really think about its intent, is to direct engineering resource to the areas of greatest risk, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you sort by risk priority number, RPN, and you take the ones with the highest number, and that's the ones you address first. So really, in concept, that's a project management tool. Where should we put our resource? So the idea of you have 150 line items, you're going to address them all, that kind of defeats that principle of prioritizing things, because the reality is there's always limited resource, and you're going to run out of resource, whether it's schedule, time, money, people. So by ranking them top to bottom, you then establish a cutoff line where it's not based on all the program goals of what you're trying to accomplish. You're not going to invest anymore in addressing these risks. So if you do just assign, every single line item in action to somebody, that's just overwhelming. And effectively, in some ways, I feel defeats the purpose of it being a tool to help focus energy until you've decided that, hey, do you know what? That's as far as we're going. So that's kind of where I'm at on that.
Yeah, and I completely agree. I didn't mean to say that you work on all 150 risk items that you find.
People do. It does happen. I mean, it does happen where people, attempt to take action on everything, and that can be paralyzing.
Right. It is a prioritization tool. Yeah. Where would you draw the line or set the limit? Sometimes I've heard organizations say, okay, any RPN over 100, or yeah. I've read, well, you take the top 10% of your items, or you do the top 10 things.
Yeah. I usually have a little talk with a team when I hear that, and I say that there should never be a predefined before you start cutoff line. We do everything over 100 or we don't, because that doesn't make sense to do that in advance. What makes sense is to, as you're taking your as you're finding the actions you have to do, you can't predict how much resource the first action is going to take, or the second or the third investigation. And at some point, your resource is like a gas tank. It's going to get used up. And, I think that it comes down to, once you have all those things in areas of investigation, and your team and what you have for schedule and manpower, you then just allocate that until you feel like that's as far as you need to go. Obviously, if you have something on there that's the 17th line item and you think it could kill somebody, well, you're going to have to decide, you're late to market release or whatever, or you get more resource somehow to get down to that one. Because obviously the 1 through 16 are also pretty bad. But then to have, done a cutoff of like, no, we're stopping at the 15th one, but seven, like that you can kind of see how it doesn't make sense to me to establish the amount you're going to do in advance. It's about balancing program resources. So I think that cutoff kind of happens naturally. when you realize you're at a point where these are risk priority numbers, that's what they're labeled. You're at a point, you're down to the line item where the risk is okay to have, and you know, and it balances out about right with the resource you have in time to market. And you're like, okay, that's about as far as, you know, we're going with this one.
Yeah, I agree with your approach. I've seen the FME templates though, where based on the RPN numbers, you know, the fields turn red.
Right.
And then, and that's a preset number. And now all of a sudden a manager says, well, everything that's red, you have to,
you know,
you have to work on. The question is, why is it red? Where did those numbers come from?
Right. And it always magically lines up with a nice round number, nice rounded off number, you know. And yeah, those are the DFMEAs that get done and filed away in a filing cabinet and forgotten about. And it's those are the ones that give them a bad name. So that's what I feel.
Yeah.
So, I'm a big advocate. I mean, they're fantastic. It's a great tool. It's good for when you're starting a testing program, designing a new product. There's so many good applications for it, but it's like a sword in the sense that you can do a lot of great things with it, but you can do a lot of damage if you're, you know, using it wrong. You'll cut off your own arm. It's just, which unfortunately seems to happen a lot. So it's good. Well, good.
Yeah, and most people probably don't get the proper training on it either. I'm just learning as I go along, and then different companies do it differently, and then you look and discuss with colleagues, well, how do you do it? What's your best practice?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Every industry, like you mentioned, you know, aerospace and automotive, they each have their own standards. I know that, like, I work with Boeing, they have their own standard that, like, you're not allowed to participate in unless you've gone through the Boeing training and the Boeing, you know. So, yeah, it's any group you're with is going to have probably a pretty diverse background in it with a lot of different common practices.
Yeah, and I think the smaller companies often don't have that kind of training available.
No.
You know, then it's challenging for the people in an FMEA to kind of come to a consensus if they come from different places. Well, we did it this way. No, but we did it this way.
Right. Yeah. Well, good. Well, that was a good discussion. And thank you for letting me surprise you with the topic.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, I liked it. Thank you, Adam.
Yeah, and if anybody out there has a 93 Toyota Camry, we're just giving you a heads up that Toyota's telling you to give it up and move on. So, all right. Well, thank you, Chris. It was a good talk.
Yeah, thanks, Adam.
All right. Bye. Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.